Hello and welcome to The World This Week, the inauguration edition with me, Gavin Lee. It is week one of the new Trump administration. First, we saw a no-holds-barred swearing-in ceremony in a room stormed by Trump supporters 4 years ago. 1,500 insurrectionists would soon be pardoned and out of prison within hours. Former President Biden sat politely behind as his successor spoke of plans to reverse what he called a horrible betrayal. He promised a new golden age of American expansion, talk of taking back the Panama Canal, planting American flags on Mars, and delighting the tech billionaires sitting in our front row seats. America's manifest destiny, he called it.
Just a few months ago, in a beautiful Pennsylvania field, an assassin's bullet ripped through my ear. But I felt then, and believe even more so now, that my life was saved for a reason. I was saved by God to make America great again.
It's been the first full week of a ceasefire in Gaza, the guns going silent on Sunday. The first three hostages released, a moment micromanaged by Hamas to show they're still a fighting force after 470 days of war. Dozens of Palestinian prisoners set free too. And on the ground, aid agencies say they've been struggling to physically get aid to the north of the Strip and past the criminal gangs waiting to loot the lorries. We're going to look at the chances of this ambiguous and complex deal aiming not for peace, but sustained calm.
This is the first aid I've received in 6 months. There was no aid of any kind before the ceasefire. With the beginning of the truce, aid is finally coming.
And it's been a week that's seen NATO's chief declare the alliance is in crisis mode and saying it's in a really bad place because of underspending in the organisation. Well, the man nicknamed the Trump whisperer, Mark Rutte, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, said Europe needed to wake up fast and to protect Ukraine and itself.
The problem, of course, is that we are not yet all at 2%. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that 2% is not nearly enough. To your point, it is not nearly enough. We are safe now. But NATO, collectively, is not able to defend itself in 4 or 5 years if we stick to the 2%.
Well, to talk about that and more this week, let's bring in our panel. Paris correspondent for Time magazine, Vivian Waltz. Great to have you on the programme, Vivian. We talked about this a lot last year, the eventuality of Trump 2.0. It's finally happened. What have you made of this week and what have you been working on?
Funnily enough, I've been talking to people in Greenland this week. Yes, it's been a truly momentous week. Not that we didn't expect it. I think what we've learned this week is you actually have to take Donald Trump seriously at his word. He laid out what he's going to do, and he's doing it. The question now is where we go from here.
We have to take Donald Trump at his words. Let's bring in independent journalist and another great friend of the programme, Anne Bagger-Marie. And in the words of one of the former spin doctors in the UK, Alan Evans, it's a great week to bury bad news, given the momentous events in Gaza and the US. Tell us about what's got your attention this week.
Well, I've been trying to figure out how to parse this flood of executive orders and announcements out of the United States. I've been trying to separate the wheat from the chaff, the head fakes from the serious policy-based initiatives that might actually have a chance of getting through. And I'm feeling a little PTSD from 2017 through 2021, when every day journalists like us would wake up and say, what happened overnight and what can I make of it? And it was kind of a constant series of churns in those 4 years. And, you know, we're right back in it again.
I think you've hit it on the head. The bluster, a hyperbole, comments of exactly what's going on versus what is really going on. The amount of things that are hitting you is an avalanche this week, hasn't it? Also with us, Amar Abed Rabot. Great to have you here. French-Syrian photojournalist, awarded the Knight of Art and Letters from the French government for his work. Amar, thank you for joining us. Tell us about your travels in the last, well, in recent days.
Recent days I've been, of course, to Syria, where I couldn't go for 15 years. So it was an incredible moment and very moving. Forget about the work. Of course, the work was very interesting, and I can see some photos here. But also personal, I mean, the emotions, the moment. The moment was extraordinary. And then last week I was also covering President Macron. We can see here one of the photos, traveling to Lebanon for one day, and that was interesting because you know, France is still have always this incredible or bizarre relationship with Lebanon, and even if it's quite powerless on many things happening there, but still the French president can go and spend a day walking in the street and eating local food with people or posing for selfies. And many people were telling me, oh, can he do that in France? And I said, after the summer troubles in politics, I'm not that sure, but definitely in Lebanon it was.
Or he'd be quickly involved in a shouting match if he does, as we've seen in recent months. And I can guess, from your lapel badge that you are, at the moment, still full of optimism about a blossoming future for Syria?
Of course. I mean, nothing can be worse than the years of Assad that we lived for 50 years or more. And it's also, it's a moment where we all have to be part of it. We cannot stay on the side of the road, watching history in the making. Mm. And this is what I'm telling my Syrian friends, but also my French friends or my European friends, you know, to say, okay, you cannot stay on the side watching and saying, oh, they're jihadists, they're not for us, they're something. And then we'll see them going to countries that we might not like. While at this moment, they need a lot of help, they need a lot of support. We can give them this help and support and get them to our side, let's say. Mm. So yes, the badge is some optimism, but also I know that there's a lot of work to do. The revolution didn't end, the revolution started. And so there are years and years of troubles or problems, but at the end, there could be light.
It reminds me of the former MI6 top spy in the UK, just retired recently, talking this week to the BBC, saying that you don't deal with the Trump presidency of what you want it to be, you deal with the reality, and the same would apply in Syria right now, wouldn't it?
Exactly. I mean, this is what's going on the ground. Of course, it might not be what we wanted, but we have to deal with it and we have to try to make things better for Syrians and also for us, for everybody.
Great to have you with us. Let's go to Jerusalem as well. We have France 24 correspondent Noga Tarnopolsky. Hello, Noga. Great to get a chance to talk in detail tonight with you about a week that you've had on the ground over there, nearly a week that the ceasefire has held. What's it been like for you covering this?
It's been very intensive. It's been filled with a lot of emotion, both on the Israeli and on the Palestinian side. And behind the scenes, I have to say, what we haven't had enough the chance to cover, but what I've been observing is that behind the, you know, the drama of the hostage release, behind the quiet of the guns, which hasn't been much discussed, the Netanyahu government has gone full into its change of regime mode. So the efforts that Prime Minister Netanyahu was making throughout 2023, before Hamas's attack in October, those efforts that caused a complete popular uprising in Israel, those are now back with less declarations and less announcements, but the government is passing authoritarian laws at a rapid clip and seems to want to take advantage of these 6 weeks of the first phase of the ceasefire to basically ensure its hold on power through not really democratic means.
Well, it takes us back to, for some perspective, the Alan Evans quote on a good week to bury other news if the world is lucking away, especially in the vacuum of the ceasefire. Noga, great to have you with us. And so we begin Monday morning, the White House Inauguration Day, beginning with quaint tradition, the pre-inaugural tea ceremony, signifying peaceful transition of power. It's how the Obamas welcomed the Trumps in 2017, although the Trumps refused to show the same courtesy to the Bidens on the morning of the now infamous January the 6th, 2021. This time, behind the smiles and forced politesse, President Biden was preparing his last act of office, bestowing controversially presidential pardons upon his siblings. Fearful that his successor, the man he called a fascist and compared to Hitler, would target them as an act of political vengeance. for this man, President Trump. He was saving the insults for the inauguration speech. 30 minutes in all, the first six of them aimed at his predecessor, who sat poker face while it was hard not to want to shout, pantomime style, he's behind you.
My recent election is a mandate to completely and totally reverse a horrible betrayal and all of these many betrayals that have taken place, and to give the people back their faith, their wealth, their democracy, and indeed their freedom. From this moment on, America's decline is over. For American citizens, January 20th, 2025 is Liberation Day.
In America, the president said, was about to enter its golden age. And with that, Donald Trump set out his own legacy, his desire to be known as a peacemaker, a unifier, he said. And his ever-loyal MAGA-hatted supporters seated right at the back. There were certainly no cheap seats for the tech bro billionaires lining the front. And listening to the president outline what he called America's manifest destiny and time for expansion.
The United States will once again consider itself a growing nation, one that increases our wealth, expands our territory, builds our cities, raises our expectations, and carries our flag into new and beautiful horizons. And we will pursue our manifest destiny into the stars, launching American astronauts to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars.
Thumbs up from Elon Musk. Well, next, the avalanche of announcement. Giant Sharpie pen time in the signing of executive orders. Declaring a national emergency at the southern border. Classifying Mexican drug cartels as terrorists. Starting a roundup of illegal immigrants for deportation. Announcing the end of birthright citizenship, which has already run into legal problems. There was also leaving the World Health Organization. Quote, bring back free speech to America, ending government policies on diversity and gender, quote, social engineering, and recognizing only two sexes, male and female. And he signed some of them in front of his supporters inside the Capital One Arena and gave this running commentary along the way.
Why don't you say what I'm signing?
Sure. The first item that President Trump is signing is the rescission of 78 Biden-era executive actions, executive orders, presidential memoranda, and others. Thank you, sir. Thank you. The next item here is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty.
Okay, Anne Bagger-Marie, first thoughts. What stood out to you the most, perhaps, from that inauguration day?
What stood out for me the most was how lacking it was, despite the words of the new president, in any sense of what really made America great, which was the respect for democratic values and the desire to model those and expand them beyond the borders of America, not expand America's borders, but to carry American values, democracy, the rule of law, outside of America. The speech itself was even devoid of poetry. I mean, these are moments when presidents lift their rhetoric and inspire all of us. I'm sure somebody was inspired by this list of campaign grievances followed by a to-do list of executive orders that were about to come, but it wasn't an inauguration speech. And I think what was most profoundly disappointing about the whole thing is that, as Vivian has said, we knew this was coming. This is who this man is. He's a showman. He's transactional. His vision stops at what's good for him. And we knew all of these things. So for me, Inauguration Day really encapsulated all of that. And it's what happens now is going to be interesting. One commentator for The Atlantic said, essentially, the Trump presidency may have just peaked. because this was the eyes of the world on him. This was the opportunity for him to set out and throw his Sharpies into the crowd and declare what he wants without any pushback. The pushback started almost immediately. So I guess what I would probably say to anybody who watched these ceremonies and enjoyed them, I hope you had a good time, because I have a feeling it's going to get a lot tougher for you to feel good about what's going on.
Vivian, Anne talked about the list of grievances and also this transactional relationship. I heard some American presenters this week talking about the era of the deal is now upon us. What have you made, or how would you sum up, in fact, the first week of Trump 2.0?
Look, I think perhaps the most shocking optic, obviously, was having the tech titans behind him. By the way, also having Bernard Arnault and children behind him. So he wanted to surround himself with uber wealth. And the message was, I'll give you whatever you want. And he will set out to do that. Now, within that, there's a whole lot of other things, and I've got to agree with Anne. This is the high point. He's signed all sorts of deals that are either not going to go through or that are going to make a lot of people, including a lot of Republicans, very unhappy. Scrapping the battery factories, which are mostly in Republican states, you know, trying rolling back electric vehicle subsidies. Again, the EV factories are being built in Republican states. You know, pulling out of the World Health Organization. Wait till we have the next pandemic, which is sure to happen sometime. So I think that he has massively overstepped his mark. A lot of it is not going to pass because it can't get through Congress. And it is going to probably, and I would say hopefully, cause a massive rupture within the Republicans, who are right now like completely cowed, but they won't be for long.
And it's what the Democrats make of this, too, on the losing side. And I think one of the viral moments, Amar, aside from Melania's hat and the inability of Trump to kiss her with it, was the reaction from Hillary Clinton when President Trump talked about renaming the Gulf of Mexico. Let's take a look at this.
A short time from now, we are going to be changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America.
Okay, so a bit of fun on the sidelines. Amar, when you look at this speech, and I also talked about manifest destiny was a recurring theme, evoking the days of the Wild West and the frontiers. What was your take on that?
First of all, I'm very much fearing... I mean, this is the United States of America. It's like a lighthouse for the world. So I'm very much fearing that many people who are allies or not allies, but who would be inspired by saying, oh, I don't like the name of this area, I don't like this or I don't like that, and they could be, I mean, we could be really entering into a mess, and they would say, oh, but the Americans did it, why wouldn't we? I mean, it's so this is something. Then I was reading some of the words. Some of the words were totally meaningless when he talks about the day of liberation. Of liberation of what? I mean, we all come from countries that may have been occupied one day or another. So the liberation, we know exactly what it means. I mean, we're in Paris. It's a city where liberation is celebrated every year, etc. But the liberation from what? Like a hidden state or something that was occupying. I mean, it's very unbearable conspiracy perfume that I dislike a lot, and also other words that were totally meaningless. When he says the golden age again, I mean, when we look today at the United States of America, it's one of the richest states in the world. It has the tech that rules our lives. It has, I mean, it is great. So what's the golden age? What's the great again means? And it's a pity to have all the people running after this and repeating the slogans or the sentences that are, in a way, meaningless for me.
Meaningless slogans, yet they catch on, like America Great Again. They have rhythm, people can follow and believe in something. And Noga, in Jerusalem, I'm interested to your take, just watching inauguration week from Jerusalem, especially listening to his goals, saying, my legacy will be, I'm the unifier, I'm the peacemaker.
Right. There were some very interesting details. This is the first week of this new ceasefire, truce, and prisoner for hostage exchange in this region. And Donald Trump received quite a bit of credit. His envoy, his new, at the time, incoming envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, was said to have shown up in Jerusalem for just a few hours on a Saturday morning, and basically said to Netanyahu, you get this done or there will be repercussions. So among the families of hostages here, there was this feeling of kind of, wow, maybe he's on our side. And then we saw during the inauguration parties that you just showed, several members of these families were on the stage with Donald Trump beside Steve Witkoff. They were all wearing these yellow scarves that have become the symbol of their hopes to release their loved ones. I think it's worth mentioning their children, their parents, their siblings who were stolen by Hamas during its invasion of Israel are by and large civilians. Some were uniformed soldiers, conscripts aged 18 or 19 who were not armed. And Donald Trump used their presence there basically as a prop in order to announce that he was freeing convicted violent insurrectionists, including those who had, you know, really harmed police officers on January 6th of 2021. And so, you know, it was a week in which we were buffeted here. On the one hand, the sense Donald Trump might still surprise us. Mm. And on the other hand, this is who Donald Trump is. He's transactional. He will use even the most victimized people, those who are just begging to see their loved ones back, you know, as a political bludgeon.
It's interesting. Like you say, the equivalency of genuine hostages and those who were convicted criminals, and not all of them since, like the heads of the Proud Boys, for example, and the Oath Keepers, have had their sentences commuted, not pardoned. So there's still big implications about what happens to those, and like you say, the equivalency of that, and many would say it was distasteful. And something Vivian mentioned a short while ago as well is he's having problems legally already, and one of those is on birthright citizenship. Mm. Talk us through the obstacles there. This is in your legal framework that you've often looked at. Mm.
Well, the big obstacle, of course, is the U.S. Constitution and when it was written and then later amendments and jurisprudence related to that is very, very clear that anyone born in the United States is a United States citizen. It's what the French call droit au sol, which means right of land. If you're on the soil, you're an American. There have been some carve-outs. Diplomats have agreed that that would not be the case for their children. But by and large, it is as settled law as can possibly be. It's been challenged a few times, always, always batted down and said, this is what we believe. So, you know, in putting this out there as an executive order, the planning is, I wasn't in the room, but I'm 99.9% positive. The planning was, let's set this out here, let's see what the legal challenges are, and let's litigate this all the way up through the legal system. It was foregone that this was going to end up in court. Now, what Trump is probably hoping for is that it goes all the way to the Supreme Court, and it may just do that. Mm-hmm. Certainly, if he has anything to do with it, it will. He seems to think that he has the Supreme Court in his back pocket because he named three of the justices, and he has received some pretty favorable rulings, including the ruling last year about immunity for the president during his official acts. But he hasn't won all the time. So it is a bit of a gamble. But with him, as he said about other initiatives that he's proposed and that he was pretty sure he wouldn't get through, it doesn't really matter because it's the chaos, it's the causing of the fear that means that he won.
Well, he can also say if he doesn't win, he tried it. It was the swamp that ruined it for us.
And so that's a promise made and promise kept. It's the campaign
win-win
promise. It's a win for him.
Tell us something. You talked earlier, and I want to ask you about this, Vivian, and talked about sorting the wheat from the chaff. There's so much that's happened this week. Now, one of those moments that could be something or nothing and yet has been a viral moment of this week And I want to ask you this. Well, watch it first, but what was Elon Musk doing here? Elon Musk. Let's see if we can take a look at Elon Musk in action during the inauguration.
Elections, they come and go. Some elections are, you know, important, some are not. But this one, this one really mattered. And I just want to say thank you for making it happen. Thank you.
Okay, what's your take?
Musk's take? It's just kind of, you know, exuberance. The rest of the world's take? It's a Nazi salute. You don't have to be a genius to know that. Anybody, you know, alive today would know that. So he's a smart guy. He knows what he's doing. And he is a guy for whom the visuals are extremely important. So his message was, we are going to rule, you know, ruthlessly.
It's interesting because his response to Next is exactly what you said. He said, frankly, quote, there needs to be better dirty tricks. The everyone is Hitler attack is so tired. And his algorithm of those supporters that we can't, even if we unfollow, have to see if we're on X, their argument was it was a Roman salute. It predates that. Whatever happened in the Hitler years, it's something different. And yet Noga in Jerusalem, the Israeli government were quick to support him, weren't they?
Well, specifically Prime Minister Netanyahu, who put out, I think we have to say, an astonishing tweet saying that Elon Musk is being falsely smeared. So that he didn't directly address the Sieg Heil, but he did defend Elon Musk as a friend of Israel. He wants to call Elon Musk a friend of himself. It's really, I think, worth pausing for a moment. The Prime Minister of Israel, who is the son of an expert, a historian expert on European anti-Semitism, basically got down on his knee and defended a titan who used a Sieg Heil, a Hitler salute. I want to add something else about the way Israel is viewing Donald Trump. Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial Center, considered the gold standard for any, you know, reactions, any commentary on anything related to the Holocaust. I asked them several times to please react both to Musk's use of this Nazi salute and to the Prime Minister's almost defense, certainly a defense of Musk, and they simply didn't get back to me.
Very interesting. That is fascinating, Noga. Just a quick final word on this issue. When you look at this through a lens of a photojournalist, through imagery, how's this week been for you?
Very busy, very rich. I wonder if we're going to have 4 years like this, or as you said, if it's the end of the momentum. I'm also very much surprised by this whole affair about the birth law, because it's very important to the USA, and maybe Donald Trump forgot, but this is a country of immigrants. It's exactly the country of immigrants, and that's why for them it's very important where you give birth. The kid is American, and it's been like this for 200 years. I mean, unless I'm mistaken, but it's weird that something so important in the psyche, in the DNA of the country, etc., can be wiped out by signature on an order. So it's very interesting to see how the courts, and I've seen already one court already, I think, declared it non-constitutional. Yes. Mm-hmm.
We're the start of a long process now. We're to be continued. Well, on Sunday, the war ended in Gaza. At 11:15 local time, the guns stopped. Only the second time in 470 days of fighting. The first lasted just a week. This time, the first phase set at 42 days. If it can last, the second and third will see the complete withdrawal of Israeli troops and then the rebuilding of a territory currently in rubble and ruins. The release of the first three hostages happened Sunday afternoon, an opportunity for Hamas propaganda, and a show of force is what they chose, picking a rendezvous point in Gaza City where its fighters were filmed holding back a baying crowd. Handy the newly released captors to the Red Cross, military fatigues, automatic weapons of the Qassam Brigade. The message was sent that Hamas is still in charge in Gaza after surviving 15 months of fighting. The likely reality is different. Its leadership decimated. It's clearly not completely destroyed. And if there's a security vacuum in the weeks and months ahead, this is a sign Hamas 2.0 could reform and regenerate. So it speaks of the need for a plan for Gaza, how it's rebuilt and how it is governed. And meanwhile, the first 90 Palestinian prisoners were released in the early hours of Monday morning. And on the ground in Gaza, a devastated population started to head back, as we just saw, leaving displacement shelters to see what was left of their homes and lives. Well, let's start with you, Noga, watching on, reporting these developments all week. And you were really disturbed, I think I'm right to say, by the optics of the Hamas hostage release, weren't you?
I was. I confess that I was disturbed by all sides' handling of it. I don't expect from Hamas anything different than what they did. They released images that showed them to be a merciless power. And we saw these poor young women, like dressed in hot pink, kind of crawling through what looked like a braying crowd of masked armed men. The images were pretty harsh. But the problem, I think, is a media issue, because since these were the only images we had, most of us transmitted them without giving the context of calling this propaganda. And in fact, we ended up relying on Gazan civilians, on very brave Gazan civilians, who in some cases used drones to take pictures from further away, and thus proving to us that in fact it was all just scenery, that Hamas had created almost a set piece of all these armed men surrounding these women to give a certain impression, and that there were no crowds on the street. And I want to say, on the Israeli side, these images that we're seeing were released by the government press office, which is a branch of the prime minister's office in Israel. And what we're seeing are images of these young women encountering their mothers for the first time in 15 months. I had even a conversation about this with the head of the government press office, who told me, well, their families gave permission. And so I want to say there's something prurient about this. I don't think we have the need or the right, you know, to see every whimper of a young woman seeing her mother for the first time in 15 months. And the other thing is, they're all adults. No one has the right to give authorization in their name. And to even give more context, in some of the cases, certainly in the case of Romy Gonen, the 24-year-old who was released, her mother was threatened by supporters of Netanyahu during these long months in which she fought for her daughter's life. She was threatened that if she kept criticizing the prime minister, her daughter would pay the price. And so imagine the extent of coercion. She was not in a position to say, no, don't take these pictures. And so my feeling, as you noted, has been that this was really opportunistically handed by all of the powers involved.
It's very interesting. So on the one hand, it's about a moment of privacy taste. It's allowing the hostages and not giving yourself away to the need of showing everything in that moment for the government press office. And yet, what are your thoughts about the TV coverage itself of what happened in Soraya Square, Gaza City? Would you have not shown that? Would you have delayed that or just allowed the context of what you saw when it happened, which was that the crowd looked very, as you said, tight, close angles. It was a huge Hamas contingent. You come away in the drone shot, you see it was very heavily stage managed.
Right. Look, I think it's important, as you did at the beginning of this show, to call it what it is. I don't think we can not show these images, especially when they're being bounced around the world. There's no point in being prim about images that everyone can see and everyone is seeing. But I think our role as news platforms, as news agencies, is to give the context. And as we are showing this, to say these very difficult images are part of Hamas's propaganda. We're showing them to you because we have no other images. Now we see that these hostages are alive. But keep in mind, this is part of Hamas's public relations barrage.
Good point. Do you agree with the point about how you cover it, the difficulties of it, and also the need to show the hostages versus how much you show the hostages?
Oh, Noga is absolutely right. Context is everything. And our role as journalists is to present, as the great Washington Post editor Ben Bradley used to say, the nearest obtainable version of the truth, but also give readers a sense of how that truth is obtained and what we're showing them. No, it's absolutely true. I was reminded with the seeing of the reunion of the hostages with their families in this very private, intimate setting, I was remembering the Vietnam-era footage you used to see in the United States on television every night of soldiers coming home after their tour of duty and being greeted by their families on the tarmac at Joint Base Andrews or wherever it was they were arriving. But that was a public forum. They were out in the open. I don't know anything about the kinds of permissions they got for that, but at least it didn't feel as though it didn't feel like an invasion of privacy. So I think it's very, very useful for someone like Noga to be able to say, I know the backstory to this, and we'll show you the images. You're absolutely right. You can't be prim and not show something that's available wherever else. But what we can do as responsible news organizations is to give the context.
I think the other problem for the continuation for the ceasefire, Vivian, that sits awkwardly against Benjamin Netanyahu's pledge to annihilate Hamas, is stage managed or not, these were Hamas fighters who'd pulled together to show that they are not defeated, however small it is, hard to read right now. And the Israeli foreign minister, Gideon Saar, saying this week Hamas has not been destroyed after 15 months. So you look at the scenario and say, how do they get to the next stage, given the pressure that will be on Benjamin Netanyahu?
Absolutely. And before Tony Blinken retired as Secretary of State last week, he did say that intelligence shows that Hamas has recruited as many fighters as it has lost in this war. So they basically back to zero. And in fact, for Hamas's purposes, probably better than zero, because they're getting hundreds and hundreds of people out of Israeli prisons. Many of them are obviously imprisoned unfairly with no basis, but many of them are not. Mm-hmm. And so both sides have extremely tough decisions going forward. And it seems to me, Noga can correct me, but it seems to me that any single little thing could really blow up this ceasefire. And it is going to have to last for months. So phase two also risks Bibi Netanyahu's coalition falling apart. So then he has to, like, weigh up, does he, you know, do what he promises President Trump is going to do and see the ceasefire through at the cost of his coalition and possibly prompting elections that will cast him out. So there's an awful lot that we're going to go through in the next few weeks.
In the next few weeks?
Don't forget the time there's the ceasefire in Gaza, there is also a new military operation in the West Bank, in Jenin.
Absolutely.
And of course, all this military pressure on the civilians do fabricate a lot of young terrorists or young fighters for the next years. So it is a real issue. I mean, maybe Hamas lost a lot of fighters in the last 15 months, but probably there are so many more. When you look at the state of Gaza now, when you look at how it is, the destructions, it's, of course, many young people who have no hope, no place to go. It's a huge prison. Will be happy to join and fight again or something. So I don't know how the targets of Bibi are met or not.
Well, we're kind of, it feels, doesn't it, Noga, as well, to Vivian's point as well, we're still in the weeds. We're talking about, you know, how you militarily handle and governmentally handle an exchange of hostages. And another issue right now that's happening as of Friday, which is that the next set of hostages appear to be on the Hamas list. They are IDF spotters, four women who are working at the surveillance base taken, and Israel saying that's not part of the plan. So that could upset things, and yet we're not talking about the day after. And that's not something Benjamin Netanyahu's been talking about. Why is that?
That's something that Prime Minister Netanyahu has specifically refused to talk about because, as Vivian just said, that risks his hold on power in Israel. Any discussion will provoke his ministers to say, well, no, we're going to occupy, as many have done, by the way, we'll occupy Gaza forever. The Israel armed forces will be there. Some of his ministers have gone so far as to say, we're going to kick the Gazans out of Gaza. We're going to repopulate it. So he has very extremist ministers who he has never scolded or put in their place. He has allowed this talk to continue. Meanwhile, as you say, he's saying the exact opposite to both American administrations. You can count on me to keep this deal in place. And he really is between a rock and a hard place. And it's unclear right now how he's going to figure it out. There is one thing I just want to specify so that we don't lose track. Secretary of State Blinken, when he mentioned those figures about Hamas fighters, was actually quoting IDF figures. Mm-hmm. And they're not about all of the war. They were referring to just since the last few weeks, since Israel engaged in the new operation in northern Gaza, and in this period of a few weeks, the IDF did say, and Blinken did cite it, that Hamas was able to recruit new fighters at the rate that it was losing them. But this is just a matter of weeks, and we're talking about two dozen or so fighters. In the course of this entire war, Hamas, of course, has not been completely destroyed, as we see. In fact, they're negotiating, but Hamas has been almost completely destroyed as a fighting force.
Very good point. And moves afoot. We hear from Saudi Arabia, Qatar as well, that they're willing to put billions in on the rebuild, but not right now, not if they're going to get destroyed again. Noga, thank you. It's got time to mention something that could easily get lost this week. But in the Swiss city of Davos, the scene of the World Economic Forum's yearly get-together, the exclusive ski resort for the bigwigs of industry, world leaders, academics, who meet to discuss the significant global themes, pressing issue of the day. It was the NATO chief, Mark Rutte, who made some of the biggest headlines with a frank assessment of the state of the defence alliance as he appeared at an event called the Ukrainian Breakfast among a panel discussing the war and the chances of peace over tea and toast in the Davos Congress Centre. NATO is in crisis mode, he said. Let's take a listen.
And the whole of NATO, from California up to and including Ankara, is in terms of ammunition producing in a full year what Russia is producing in 3 months. And as I said yesterday, Russia is not bigger as an economy, the size of the economy, than Belgium and the Netherlands combined. So we are really in crisis mode here. So first, money, much more to be spent, fast. The ones not on 2% have to get to the 2% in the next couple of months. We cannot wait any longer. And then we have collectively to move up, and we will decide on the exact number later this year, but it will be considerably more than that too. And then on industry production, we are really in a bad place here. And don't think that China is producing crap like they did 20 years ago. The ships they are now building, and they have now a bigger navy than the US has, are much better, are at least quality-wise at the same level.
And one of a few people in the world that have the name the Trump Whisperer, what do you imagine the method behind that message was?
Well, I mean, one of Donald Trump's clear messages, even from his first mandate, was that NATO doesn't pay its fair share and European nations need to step up and start coughing up more money or the United States will threaten to pull out. We're back where we were in 2017. It's the same discourse. And lest we think he doesn't mean it, he also pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accords during his first mandate. Joe Biden took them back in, and Trump has pulled them out again. So he actually, I think, has the will to actually pull out of NATO. On the other hand, Trump, being transactional and being what he thinks of as the artisan of the deal, one way in which you bring people to the table and kind of gather the adrenaline to get something done is to issue threats and to issue warnings. Now, Rutte has just thrown down a gauntlet in front of his European partners. You know, we're in trouble here. We do need to step up. We need to take seriously the idea of a non-American NATO, and we need to pull together money, resources, and concentrate our minds on Europe defending Europe. And not just defending Europe, but stepping in to bolster Ukraine, give Ukraine a future where it's pretty obvious that America lacks that will. You know, back to the inauguration, the word Ukraine was almost never spoken. It's not high on his list of priorities. So, you know, if that's the gambit, quite frankly, to me, it looks like it's already kind of working, because look what's happening between Macron and Olaf Scholz. Look what's happening between the leaders of France and Germany. They're practically dancing cheek to cheek, talking about reinforcing Europe's defences.
Which takes us to, and nicely, the last 30 seconds. I want to give you 15 seconds each, Vivian and Amar. Kurt Volker, the former Trump ambassador representative to Ukraine, said, A, the world is a safer place with Trump, and B, there'll be some kind of agreement of a freezing on the lines in 100 days. Is he right?
No, I don't think so. And Mark Rutte, and didn't mention it, but I think one of the most significant things he said is China is no longer producing what he called crap, excuse my language, on this program, but that is the big issue. And that is hanging over all of this discussion. And it's a little bit lost in the Ukraine debate, but it is very quickly becoming a major global crisis, and they're going to have to deal with it.
Amar.
No, from everything we said in this hour, I mean, from the Nazi salute to supporting Netanyahu to other issues, I don't think the world would be a safer place. It's a more scary place. It's a more risky place. And I hope we'll manage to get away the next 4 years.
Thank you, all of you, for a momentous week of an momentous discussion. So Vivian Walt, Paris correspondent for Time magazine, photojournalist Amar Abid-Rabeau, independent journalist Anne Bagamarie, and in Jerusalem, Noga Tarnopolsky. Thank you so much. A brilliant insight, as always, on a momentous week. We'll be back in 7 days for The World Next Week.